It's time for No Copay Radio, brought to you by Dr. Cog, the Denver Regional Council of Government's Area Agency on Aging. Here are your hosts, Murphy Houston and Jayla Sanchez Warren from the Area Agency on Aging.
We are back. Yeah, I know you're shocked that they'd allow us back on Cozy 101.1, but it's true. It's No Copay Radio every Sunday morning at 7:30. Brought to you by Dr. Cog, the Denver Regional Council of Government's Area Agency on Aging, 303-480-6700. I'm Murphy Houston. My partner who runs the Area Agency on Aging, Jayla Sanchez Warren, not with us today. I mean, she's just busy doing all kinds of stuff to help people out. We appreciate that. But who is back with me today? Our friend Dr. John Douglas, joining us from Tri-County Health, formerly with the CDC, who was fighting the flu last week. John, how you feeling?
Murph, I'm feeling a lot better. I do want to say that I'm not sure still exactly what it was, because we typically don't get outpatient diagnostic testing for anything but COVID, but I'm definitely on the mend, and I'm very happy to be with you this morning.
Well, there's a lot of that flu going around. I mean, I keep up with it as best we can, but this flu, this edition of the flu is really, really outrageous, isn't it?
It is. It looks like it is clearly on the way to being a more severe year than we've had really in a long time, maybe even in 10 years. And part of the thinking of that is we've got a sort of an immunity deficit is the term of art that's used to say, basically, look, there's not been a lot of flu going around the last couple of years, nor has there been much RSV. And we periodically get exposed to these viruses, and that boosts our immunity, just like we've learned it does with COVID.
Right.
And that hasn't happened, and so we're looking at what seems to be a pretty bad year.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I was going to say, it seems to be affecting people of all ages, not just one segment of our population, seniors, kids, it's everybody.
I think that's right, although it is true that, in general, flu makes older folks sicker. The same folks that COVID attacks more aggressively also end up being more impacted by the flu, and that appears to be the case this year so far, at least looking at who's been hospitalized. So my guess is that our older residents, myself included, by the way, who are going to be at greater risk. I think it's worth pointing out that the early information suggests that the vaccine is a pretty good match for the circulating strains. If you needed more incentive to get a vaccine, that ought to be something to consider, along with the fact that it's going to be a really bad year. The other thing I want to say is, or want to emphasize, is whether you've gotten the vaccine or not, if you get the rapid onset of an upper respiratory infection, fever, cough, body aches, et cetera, and your COVID test is negative, try to get to your doctor to discuss the potential for flu medication. We've talked about that every week. I had the occasion to prescribe it for a patient just this past week. Huge difference, but it's got to be started within 48 hours. So remember that option is out there, but the window to get it's pretty tight.
Well, and I found out quite by accident the other day. I was with my wife as she was getting the final report on her annual physical. And the doctor at the time, she says, Murphy, you're kind of hacking a little bit. Are you all right? And I go, yeah, I'm fine. She said, well, let me swab you for the flu. I didn't know they did like a COVID-type swab for the up the nose for the flu. I was luckily negative. It was just a kind of a cold. But you can get that done. Is that correct?
You can get it done. Not every doctor's office has it, but many do. But it's something you have to see a healthcare provider, an urgent care clinic, et cetera, to get. You can't go into the drugstore like a COVID test to get your own flu test.
No, that would not work very well, I guess. But speaking of that, boy, I saw this, and maybe you've seen it too, John, and you probably know more than I do. I was on Nine News just the other night about the shortage of medicines like amoxicillin and that Tamiflu you talk about. And there was this mom up in Firestone whose daughter needed amoxicillin. She had to go to like 18 different locations to finally find it. What's going on with that? Is there a shortage?
There is a shortage. And honestly, Murph, I'm not sure exactly the reason. I personally take amoxicillin because I've got a hip replacement. And when I go to the dentist, you need to take that on
yes.
a, quote, preventive basis. So I'm very personally tuned into that shortage, and I have heard exactly the same story that you've just described. You know, we periodically see this kind of thing come up with, quote, generic antibiotics. I mean, amoxicillin's been around since before I went to medical school. I mean, it's a really old drug that, frankly, has still got some uses, but the profit margin on making it once the patent's gone is such that there can sometimes be variable incentives for manufacturers to make sure they've got all the supply chains worked out and everything ready to create the drug. I don't know if that's what's happened with amoxicillin, but we have seen that with other, quote, generic antibiotics in the past.
And what about the Tamiflu? You were talking high last week about if you got the flu or something like that, get a prescription for Tamiflu. Now that's hard to find.
Yeah, I've heard rumors of spot shortages. I haven't heard anything as broad as amoxicillin, but that's an important one. I mean, that's what I was just referring to. Thanks for reminding me that I'm repeating myself, that I said the same thing last week. But it wouldn't surprise me if we did have shortages. Again, I haven't heard of them broadly, and certainly we're not hearing any messaging from the state health department about, you know, don't call your doctor because there's no meds out there. So could be happening in places. I don't think, at least at this point, is a widespread issue.
Well, what about over-the-counter stuff? If people can't get a prescription, what about, and that's another thing. I heard there might be a shortage of some forms of Tylenol now. Now, you'd think that would be easy to find.
Yeah, and I'd have to say, Murph, again, I haven't heard about that shortage. I would remind everybody that Tylenol is a trade name for acetaminophen, which is a longer term, but it's the active ingredient in Tylenol. You can get it in a lot of other products. So if you're looking for acetaminophen, which is a really great anti-fever, anti-pain medication, and your store is out of Tylenol, please ask if there are other products that have acetaminophen in it. Often you can find that.
And what about cough medicines? There was somebody at work here the other day. They were just hacking. So we all, you know, head for the hills and hide because we don't want it. But what do you recommend for that? What's a good over-the-counter medicine you can get for a cough?
Well, first of all, if you've got a cough or a cold, you probably shouldn't be hanging around the recording studio.
Agreed. I mean, but that doesn't happen, you know. For some reason, people in my business think, I can work no matter what happens. I will be there. I've got to be there. No, you don't. We'll take care of things. Stay home.
That's an old mentality, because once you infect three of your other coworkers, they're sick, and then your workspace is even more challenged. You know, I think the most effective over-the-counter cough medication for adults are products that contain dextromethorphan, which is a mild cough suppressant. They often have other medications in the same bottle, such as guaifenesin, which is basically a medication that loosens up secretions. So the two work together by, quote, loosening up secretions, because a lot of coughing is, I got a piece of sticky something stuck, and I'm coughing and coughing and coughing to try to get it cleared out.
That's right.
That'll sort of lubricate the joint, so to speak. And then dextromethorphan-containing products will often help with the suppression, but none of that stuff works perfectly, and there are some prescription medications if your cough's really bad, which, by the way, I experienced this past week. It can really interrupt sleep. So don't infect other people. Stay home. But I think those are some of the best remedies.
And I guess we should switch back a little bit to COVID, because I read where things are picking up, especially in Boulder County for some reason. COVID has not gone away, right, my friend?
COVID has not gone away. Colorado's actually got one of the highest rates in the country right now in terms of cases. We're number five in the U.S.
Wow.
It looks like the Four Corners area, interestingly enough, which is Colorado, Utah, Arizona, New Mexico, is one of the hottest spots in the U.S. in terms of cases and hospitalizations. You know, this stuff comes and goes and comes and goes, and for months, we were among the lowest in the country, and, you know, almost certainly because of bad weather, it's come back up again. We are seeing hospitalizations flat at this point. I do worry. It's, you know, only 17 shopping days till Christmas.
Right.
At the time we're recording, you know, that we've got time to have things COVID rear its head. And I will say that we are moving into full swing of the newest variants, the ones that start with BQ1 and BQ1.1. They're really the predominant variants that are circulating right now. So it is, Colorado is in a worse place, and I suspect it's going to get worse before it gets better.
So is that new variant very contagious?
You know, the data are not complete on this. I think the general rule is that when an Omicron family member, and we've been dealing with one Omicron family member after another since last Christmas, when a new one takes over, it's almost certainly because it's got greater competitiveness against previous strains, meaning it's more contagious, it can spread more rapidly. So I haven't seen formal measurements of it, but I would be very, very surprised if it weren't at least as contagious as what we'd seen before, BA4 and 5 or the past ones, and probably even a little bit more so.
Oh, boy. Now, here we come up to the holiday, Christmas time. You know, there'll be a lot of families gathering, a lot of Christmas parties. We got to be careful, right?
You do have to be careful, Murph. And, you know, one of the things I want to point out is that, well, right now, if you're vaccinated, COVID is a pretty manageable illness. It's the older population we remain concerned about. It's pretty clear that the new analysis done just a week or two ago indicated that it was, even if you're vaccinated, it's the older members of our community that have the greatest risk of severe COVID illness and even death. Same for influenza, as we've already talked about. But even if you're younger, I think there's a substantial chance of your holiday gathering being disrupted if you get sick.
Yeah.
And so keep in mind that whatever you can do, I mean, I'm going to Christmas parties this weekend. I'm going to try to stay in as well ventilated a place as I can. I would encourage folks to really think hard about that. If you're vulnerable, wear a mask. It's not pleasant. I get that. And then, of course, be sure that you're up to date on the vaccines if you haven't yet gotten them. I think those are the keys to trying to stay as safe as possible, along with the old mainstays of good hand washing, staying home with when you're sick. And if you venture out and you're a little bit on the edge and you start coughing or sneezing, for God's sake, please cover your mouth.
Oh, really?
With your elbow, so you're not spewing respiratory particles all over the place.
Well, I'm hearing the CDC really starting to wave the flag again of those big three things: washing your hands, wearing a mask, keeping a distance. They're really pushing it, and not just because of COVID, because of the other things going on.
Absolutely. And I think there's broad acceptance that infectious diseases that are transmitted through common pathways, respiratory particles, being spewed out by coughing, sneezing, et cetera, can generally be prevented by the same common strategies: staying home when you're sick, covering your mouth, and wearing a mask. You know, we got into a lot of back and forth about just how good the data were about COVID masking preventing transmission, and how good is the data for the other respiratory viruses. Look, we don't have specific bacterial data for hand washing. We just know that when you can remove bacterial material from your hands, you will protect against a raft of bacteria. The same is true for respiratory viruses. So when you're in public places and there may be crowds, you're going to provide broad protection by wearing a well-fitting mask.
Now, there's good words of advice. I guess just be careful and be wise. I think that's pretty much.
You don't want to spoil your holidays. You don't want to spoil somebody else's holidays. And because, you know, for goodness sake, we need as much merry and jolly as we can get.
Well, we sure do. We need that. Dr. John Douglas joins us, well, every week on No Copay Radio from Tri-County Health, formerly with the CDC. John, take care of yourself, and we'll have you back again next week here on No Copay Radio.
Okay, Murph. Take care of yourself.
Yep, you too. And we're going to take a little break here. It's on Cozy 101.1, brought to you by Dr. Cog. No Copay Radio is. the Denver Regional Council of Governments Area Agency on Aging. 303-480-6700. Hang in there. More coming up.
We now continue with No Copay Radio with your hosts, Murphy Houston and Jayla Sanchez Warren.
Welcome back. We're still on Cozy 101.1 as we are every Sunday at 7:30. No Copay Radio. I am Murphy Houston. And we're brought to you by Dr. Cog, the Denver Regional Council of Governments Area Agency on Aging, 303-480-6700, which is run by my partner, Jayla Sanchez Warren, who's not with us today. She's off doing her job as she should. But joining us now is Dr. Peter Pressman. He is an assistant professor in cognitive and behavioral neurology at the University of Colorado, where he's involved with clinical trials and other research at the University of Colorado's Alzheimer and Cognition Center, sees patients in their memory disorders clinic. And Dr. Pressman, welcome to No Copay Radio, Doc.
Thank you very much for having me, and thanks for such a thorough introduction.
Well, it's good to get the information out of a man who's got the credits. And if you don't mind, I'll call you Peter, if that's okay. And I'm sure most people do, but this topic is very, very involved with an audience that listens to No Copay Radio, either caregivers taking care of folks with Alzheimer's or dementia issues, or in families that are listening. So the first question I've got, and this is from some of the information that you've sent along, what are the primary progressive aphasias? Maybe explain what that is and how they impact language, because that kind of almost reflects in my business.
Yes, so the primary progressive aphasias are a type of dementia that many people don't know that much about. As you know, when we use that word dementia, we just mean a cognitive problem that is limiting people in their day-to-day activities. And so in Alzheimer's, the most common form of dementia in people over a certain age, 65, memory is the most common aspect of cognition to be impaired. In the primary progressive aphasias, memory is often relatively spared. However, your use of language, your use of words in various different ways becomes impaired. And people are often able to still do many other things that are part of their lives. Maybe they can build a cabin. Maybe they can go solo on a cross-country trip, but they'll have to find a way to do it while adapting to not speaking the way that they used to, or perhaps not understanding others the way that they used to.
That's got to be a very difficult transition. How do you handle that? What do you do with folks that have that situation?
Well, I would argue that it depends on what type of primary progressive aphasia that you have. Based on a more precise diagnosis and the type of language problem you're having, we can make very specific recommendations for how you can get by as best as you can. We can also offer advice to people who interact with folks who have primary progressive aphasia, or PPA, on a day-to-day basis to make communication easier for everybody. Oh. Because, as you know, communication is at least a two-way street.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it certainly is, as you and I are doing right now, as a matter of fact.
Exactly. It's hard not to become very self-conscious about communication when you're talking about it.
Yeah.
Even if you do it professionally.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I wanted to ask the question. Go ahead.
Oh, not at all. I was just going to say that there are three forms of primary progressive aphasia. There's a semantic variant in which you lose your concept of what words mean. So we could be having a conversation just like this, and maybe you bring up, hey, how do you feel about watermelon? And I might respond, what's a watermelon? It would be as if I had never heard that word before in my life, or as if it was from a foreign language.
Wow.
There's another form where you just can't make words happen. You can't coordinate your lips, your teeth, the tip of the tongue to make the word come out. And so the speech can sound tortured, and people can become very self-conscious about this.
Oh, for sure.
And there's another form, the most common form of primary progressive aphasia, which is just living in that state of tip of the tongue feeling where you're like, I know your name, I just can't quite come up with it. Can't quite find that word I'm looking for. And that just is becoming increasingly common. Now, all of us have a little bit of that as we get older. But in this form of primary progressive aphasia, the logopenic variant, it's just much more common.
Yeah, that's happened to me, believe it or not. Sometimes you're just in a conversation and the words are coming, and all of a sudden the next word, for some reason you want, stops. It's not there anymore. And that's a little uncomfortable.
Absolutely. Usually that's just normal aging. But if it is becoming much more pronounced and is a marked shift, then we need to think about neurological disorders, including primary progressive aphasias.
What kind of testing or treatments are available for someone that has the situation, or maybe other language difficulties? What do you do to help them?
So in order to establish a more accurate diagnosis, there's a number of different steps that we can take. Language is complicated. And in order to best understand where people are struggling, we have to investigate all kinds of different facets of language. For example, we will investigate, first and foremost, someone's spontaneous speech, which is great interest of mine, just
right.
Conversations, kind of like we're having now.
Right.
And listen and see if we can hear something that's unusual or abnormal. Moving from that just kind of obvious change, we will do closer investigation. How well can someone name different things?
Sure.
How well can they recognize what I'm naming? How well can they write? How well can they read? We'll also ask questions about grammar. You know, is somebody starting to simplify their language, or are they having a hard time being able to answer questions that are phrased in an unusual fashion? So, for example, if I ask, if a lion is eaten by a tiger, which animal is still alive? That's enough to give anybody just a moment's pause, but most of us will get the correct answer.
Right.
Other people will really struggle with that sort of information when presented in a grammatically unusual fashion.
Wow. So if somebody listening now has never thought about these situations with maybe a loved one or maybe themselves, what do you recommend? Do they reach out and talk to you? Can you set an appointment with you or someone else to get the help they need?
Yes. They certainly could make an appointment with me. However, they can start by talking with any neurologist, preferably one who is comfortable with these sorts of evaluations. If we're really concerned about a primary progressive aphasia, these are uncommon disorders. And so a specialist in behavior and cognition is probably preferable. Specialists will also be best positioned to coordinate resources, which can also be hard to find.
Right.
There are, for example, speech therapies, which seem to be helpful in improving quality of life and in perhaps slowing the decline of the disease.
Oh,
I have to emphasize
right.
the perhaps, because trials are still ongoing.
Sure, probably
quality
all the time.
Quality of life, I think, certainly in some situations can be improved to a much greater extent than I think is widely recognized, even by many neurologists or speech and language specialists.
Right. Right. We're talking with Dr. Peter Pressman. And, Doc, how do you apply general communication, I guess, kind of like we're talking right now? How do you apply those strategies in dementia?
So if we're discussing primary progressive aphasias, you may have very specific advice based on each diagnosis. However, any dementia can impact communication. And I think that becomes sometimes painfully obvious to people who have been in a relationship with someone for a long time, and this person is now undergoing brain changes, and communicating with them in the way that you may have learned over 50 years or more in some marriages just won't arguing that it is not, even if it's very obviously untrue what they're trying to describe. Trying to use logic and arguing with them, it's just not going to work. Similarly, people will often require more time to process what you have just said. And so some patience is going to be required in even the most common forms of dementia, such as Alzheimer's, especially as the disease advances over time. And trying not to, unless somebody asks for it, just inject, trying to correct and say, well, I know what you were going to say. Some people want that, some people don't. And you can tread on toes if you end up speaking for someone too often. Some people appreciate the help, some don't. And so we tailor our approach to each individual. Those are just a few guidelines. We'll often work with a speech and language specialist, if they're comfortable doing so, not only to help patients exercise different means of communication, but also to work with friends and family who want to know how to communicate with their loved one most effectively.
Wow.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I've known friends that are going through that right now, that situation, where they've been married a long time, then one of the members of that togetherness is changing. And you have to change yourself because it's can be very uncomfortable and sometimes argumentative, if you know what I mean.
Right. And no one's going to win that argument.
No, nobody. I agree with that for sure. So it's a partnership, as is all marriage. It's a real partnership to help out with that situation. And I think the key word you said there, Dr. Pressman, is patience. You've got to have patience.
Yeah. You know, I think that communication is one of those the most amazing and unique feats of the human brain. Other animals do communicate, clearly, but not with the sophistication that we do, not with the range of vocabulary, of inflection. And it's one of the, I think, more sensitive things than to diseases like Alzheimer's. And I think all of us struggle sometimes with communication, right?
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
I think all of us have floundered on occasion. It doesn't take much. And maybe a bad night's sleep, maybe not enough coffee. And certainly a disorder like Alzheimer's will be enough to start tipping the scales. So in our research, in our lab, we're exploring ways that we might be able to analyze spontaneous speech, kind of like what we are doing right now, for early signs of disorders like Alzheimer's, to see if we can improve detection and diagnosis. Because the field really has moved towards the view that early diagnosis counts for a lot.
Oh, it does.
Certainly.
I'm sure it does.
And I think that's...
In a lot of situations, early detection is important.
Absolutely.
So, Doc, before I let you go, if we're talking with somebody that's going through these situations right now, before I let you go, what would you recommend their first steps be?
You know, the first step is always to talk with a medical professional if you have these concerns, who can begin the evaluation. And also be willing to reach further and talk with specialists as well, particularly if there's something unusual, if it's not just memory or problems with attention, something which would selectively impact language is uncommon, and you would really benefit from more detailed expertise in that situation.
Sounds perfect. Dr. Peter Pressman, thanks so much for coming on No Copay Radio today. You opened up a lot of doors and windows for people to think about and get some help right now. Appreciate you being here.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me today.
You bet. Thank you guys for listening here on Cozy 101.1. Back next Sunday at 7:30, No Copay Radio. Brought to you by Dr. Cog, the Denver Regional Council of Governments Area Agency on Aging. Talk to you next week.
This has been No Copay Radio, brought to you by Dr. Cog, the Denver Regional Council of Governments Area Agency on Aging, 303-480-6700. Join us every Sunday at 7:30 here on Cozy 101.1.